Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Drs. Foss and Wilson are joined by Drs. Stacy Stein and Tamar Tadi for a conversation about liver cancer. Dr. Stein is assistant professor of medical oncology, and Dr. Tadi is assistant professor of medicine and digestive diseases at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by having you give us just a brief definition of liver cancer. What is liver cancer? What kind of patients get liver cancer?
So liver cancer is a primary cancer that arises in the liver. There are two major types. One is of the liver cells themselves, and that's called hepatocellular carcinoma. The other type is of the biliary cells, and that's called cholangiocarcinoma. Primary liver cancer, specifically hepatocellular carcinoma, is actually on the rise in the United States. And there are many risk factors for liver cancer, cirrhosis being by far the most important risk factor for the development of hepatocellular carcinoma. Cholangiocarcinoma can arise in any healthy person. It doesn't need cirrhosis as a precursor, and actually most people with cholangiocarcinoma don't have cirrhosis. The one risk factor for cholangiocarcinoma is a disease of the liver called primary sclerosing cholangitis, which is often associated with later development of cholangiocarcinoma.
What are some of the patient's symptoms when they get these various problems?
Well, you know, just to take one step back from that question, what's very interesting about liver cancer and different from most of the other cancers that we treat in medical oncology is that it occurs in the setting usually of longstanding liver disease. So for hepatocellular carcinoma, you know, Dr. Tadi is right, most of the patients have cirrhosis, and those can come from different things such as hepatitis B, hepatitis C, from chronic alcohol use, and even now from something that we see called NASH cirrhosis, which is caused by basically inflammation from fatty liver over many years. And so, often these patients have predisposing factors, which hopefully have been identified by someone early. Because for early stage liver cancer, there actually may be no symptoms, or the symptoms actually may be more from their underlying liver disease than the cancer per se. So what we really rely on are our colleagues out in the community to identify these patients who are high risk for getting liver cancer, such as those with hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and a longstanding alcohol history. And hopefully they are being screened periodically for early cancer starting, because we have much better outcomes when the cancer is found early.
So Tamar, you see these patients oftentimes in the liver clinic, and you and Stacy have teamed up in this effort at the Smilo Cancer Center. Can you tell us how you screen patients that you think might be at high risk, and then how you and Stacy actually work together to work on those patients?
So it's actually very important to underscore what Stacy just said, which is that you have to have an index of suspicion for underlying liver disease. The CDC has just come out with new guidelines that recommend screening for hepatitis C in all people in the United States born between 1945 and 1965, essentially calling the baby boomer generation also the Hep C generation, because this is when hepatitis C was on the greatest rise in the United States. The epidemiology data suggests that the rise in HCC is directly linked to the epidemiological curves in hepatitis C, such that people who were infected in the 1960s have had a latency period, and it actually really takes about 20 to 30 years to develop cirrhosis. So sometime around the 90s, they might have developed cirrhosis, and as that scarring process progresses over time, that's when the risk factor for liver cancer rises. So we're seeing a whole generation of people reach their sort of natural history of liver disease such that they really are now at risk for the development of liver cancer. So hepatitis B, although we don't see as much in the United States, is endemic in other parts of the world. And it's very important to really kind of compare the epidemiology. So in the U.S., there's somewhere between 20 to 30,000 new cases of HCC per year, whereas annually there are about 600,000 deaths from HCC in the globe. So there's 350 million people infected with hepatitis B. And of those 350 million, somewhere between 35 to 87 million of those people will die of hepatocellular carcinoma. So what we see in the U.S. is really the tip of the iceberg. The other major issue in the U.S. is alcoholism leading to cirrhosis and liver cancer. And it's important to ask your patients about their alcohol consumption. And then finally, probably the biggest surge in liver disease is related to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, what we call NAFLD in the liver community. And the biggest rise in terms of demographics are in children ages 11 to 19. So what's really concerning to us is that the next wave of liver cancer may come in even younger people who've developed fatty liver disease in their childhood, come to cirrhosis in their 20s and 30s, and actually present with liver cancer in their 40s. And that's actually something that we are very concerned about as being sort of the next wave of HCC once hepatitis C is actually successfully treated. Now that we have drugs that can treat hepatitis C on the order of a 75% cure rate, we're really worried about what the next wave is. So as all of this has kind of come to pass in the last 5 years, where we've really seen increasing rates, we've also seen increasing rates in our backyards at Yale New Haven Hospital, at the Veterans Hospital. And part of the sort of attempt to really establish a screening program and detect these patients early is to really work across disciplines and, you know, to colocalize in clinical settings where we can actually see our patients, deliver a cogent message on, you know, sort of what the multidisciplinary plan is. And then I can see the patient and Stacy can see the patient and I can care for their liver disease and she can care for their liver cancer, especially if it's advanced HCC, which is really, you know, the prevailing role for the oncologist right now. So that really helps us to provide, you know, very cogent care for the patient.
Since there is a connection between hepatitis and hepatocellular carcinoma, some of our listeners may be wondering, what are some of the risk factors for hepatitis?
So hepatitis B and C are the two hepatitides that we worry most about. Hepatitis A is usually a self-limited infection, so any listener shouldn't worry about hepatitis A. Hepatitis B is an infection that in Asia is often transmitted from mother to child, what we call vertical transmission. And patients can be asymptomatic for the vast majority of their life and only present later with either cirrhosis or liver cancer. Hepatitis C, so going back to hepatitis B, if you acquire it in your adulthood, which is more often the case in the United States, for example, it can be acquired from intravenous drug use, from any sharing of bodily fluids, so sexual transmission is very common. And anybody who's working in the field with blood, for example, EMTs or first responders have a risk for acquiring hepatitis B. The blood supply in the U.S. is very well screened for hepatitis B, so we see no transmission and haven't seen any in decades of this particular virus. Hepatitis C is basically was considered to be non-A, non-B hepatitis until about 1992, when they developed an assay to really check for this and were able to identify that this was indeed a different hepatitis, hepatitis C. And it is also a bloodborne pathogen in the sense that you need to somehow or other exchange blood. Now, what's very interesting is that although the vast majority of people with hepatitis C have been injection drug users, we also know that there was quite a bit of incident cases during the cocaine era where people were snorting cocaine with straws that were passed from person to person. So even that sort of microscopic contamination, one person's nasal mucosa to another, was enough to transmit the virus. And 30% of people who have hepatitis C simply cannot figure out how they contracted it. It was in the blood supply until we developed that, you know, reasonable screening technique. So if people received a blood transfusion prior to 1992, that could be a way that they contracted the virus.
There is a vaccine that we're giving our kids now and that we've all had against hepatitis B. So can you talk about the role of the vaccine in prevention and also whether there is a vaccine or will be a vaccine for hepatitis C?
So, you know, hepatitis B is a vaccine-preventable illness. It's really unfortunate that people still acquire hepatitis B. So everybody in the United States was vaccinated as of 1985. All children received this vaccination during their first year of infancy. And so we have seen a tremendous drop in the incident cases of hepatitis B, especially in the younger population. In countries in Asia and Africa where they're starting now to do population vaccination, we're also seeing tremendously, you know, lower rates of contracting the illness. So in the United States, again, it's really not that much of an issue, except in sort of endemic areas where you have a lot of immigration, for example. That vaccine is incredibly successful and prevents the illness by giving protective antibody. The issue with hepatitis C is that it's a very different type of virus. It's not as stable. It has a lot of what we call quasi-species, so it's a smart virus that tends to mutate quite easily, and that has provided problems with developing a good vaccine for that. It was also very difficult to grow and in culture, for example, so there have been a lot of scientific hurdles to developing a good vaccine. As far as the future, we're hopeful that there will be a vaccine against hepatitis C, but we're far away from that.
For hepatocellular carcinoma and cholangiocarcinoma, you mentioned a bit about the baby boomers, but are there specific age groups that tend to be affected, age at diagnosis, and is there any gender difference?
So the age groups that have the highest incidence of HCC in the U.S. are basically that decade around the mid-50s to mid-60s. And that actually coincides quite nicely with the baby boomer generation, if you think about it that way. There is absolutely a gender difference. Men are much more affected by this disease than women. We're not exactly sure why that is, but definitely more than 2-to-1 men to women. There's new data, emerging data, that was actually just discussed at one of our recent conferences, that it appears that there may be an uptick in Latin American females with HCC, probably related to non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, of which the Latino community is at most risk, based on population genetics probably more than anything else. So we do think that over time we will see these demographics and these sort of susceptibilities change with the etiology of the underlying liver disease. I do want to make the comment, though, that when you're talking about underlying sort of chronic liver disease, as Stacy mentioned, leading to cirrhosis and then hepatocellular carcinoma, that's a very well-established sort of trajectory of, you know, some sort of liver injury causing liver scarring, causing more and more avid scarring, and then ultimately leading to cancer that arises in a sick liver. Whereas cholangiocarcinoma is a very distinct cancer with a very distinct treatment, and we don't really see cholangiocarcinoma that often in cirrhosis. So they're very distinct cancers, and we kind of keep them extremely separate. In fact, you know, I run a liver tumor board, and although we often will present cholangiocarcinomas, I think they're probably better discussed in the GI tumor board, where people who sort of have more expertise in dealing with looking at the biliary tree, for example, can entertain those cases.
And you mentioned cirrhosis, and just so our listeners understand, and in the context that it's related to alcohol consumption, as a general rule, can you make a comment on how much alcohol does someone need to be concerned if they have a glass of wine every couple of days, that kind of thing?
So the guidelines from both the governing bodies of people in gastroenterology and also in internal medicine is that for males, you want to have no more than 2 drinks per day. A drink is something that needs to be defined very strictly, because some of us think of a pitcher when we think of a drink, and some of us think of a shot glass when we think of a drink. So the average drink is 4 ounces of wine 12 ounces of beer or 1.5 ounces of spirits, and that's what a drink is. So for men, it's no more than 2 drinks per day, and for women, it's no more than 1 drink per day. Having said that, we see a lot of genetic variation in terms of who's really susceptible to alcoholic liver disease and who seems to be somewhat immune to it, and we haven't teased out scientifically what those genetic differences are. But in patients who come from families with longstanding histories of alcoholism and liver disease, those patients should really think carefully about how much they're drinking.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about liver cancer, treatment with Dr. Stein and Taddy.
The American Cancer Society estimates that over 1,000 patients will be diagnosed with melanoma in Connecticut each year. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable, and new treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention, as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today we're joined by Dr. Stein and Taddy, and we're discussing liver cancer. Stacy, tell us a little bit about how liver cancer or cholangiocarcinomas are actually diagnosed once you have a suspicion that someone may have one of those problems. And tell us a little bit about staging, and then we can get into treatment.
We look at these patients in a multidisciplinary setting. Often the patients have some kind of symptom that prompts imaging, whether it was on surveillance or they had a change in blood work that their liver doctor or primary doctor noticed with a change in their liver function tests or some kind of symptom. And we can actually make a diagnosis of hepatocellular carcinoma based on imaging alone, which is very unusual compared to other cancers where we always obtain a biopsy and have a tissue diagnosis before initiating any treatment. We also routinely check for all these patients at the time of diagnosis something called an AFP or alpha fetal protein. It's not elevated in all patients with liver cancer, but it's elevated in many, and sometimes that just helps kind of cement the picture of the diagnosis that we're making. So the patients usually have a CAT scan or an MRI of their abdomen, and based on certain features, we can actually see that this looks very characteristic of an HCC. For now, I'll focus on HCC because cholangiocarcinoma actually is quite different. To complete that staging, we will also get imaging of their chest and a bone scan because sometimes liver cancer can travel to the bones. So the next thing we do then when we think we have a diagnosis of HCC is to complete the staging with that imaging. And the reason why that's important is because the staging really determines what the treatment options are for each patient. If a patient has a small tumor that's in the liver or a couple of small tumors, the first important evaluation is to see if they are a candidate for a liver transplant or for a surgical resection. And these are two treatments that potentially can offer a cure to a patient. So it's very important that these patients be seen in a multidisciplinary setting. And of course, we offer that for all cancer patients at Yale, but I think that liver cancer specifically really highlights the importance of a multidisciplinary team. So basically, the patients are just at one meeting being evaluated by transplant, by surgery, by interventional radiology, by radiology, pathology, hepatology and medical oncology. And we meet weekly to really each bring our area of expertise to the diagnosis and discussing treatment options for each patient individually. And I can't stress enough how important that is to determining what, you know, the best treatment options are for each patient. So I would say, so the first determination is really to see if someone is a transplant or resection candidate. Now, you asked about, you know, about staging for patients. There's something called the AJCC staging, which we use for most cancers. And I have to say that for liver cancer specifically, it's very deficient in really giving a picture of how someone with liver cancer is doing and or what their treatment options are. And the reason for that is, going back to what I said initially, is that liver cancer is unique in the way that it occurs usually in the setting of underlying liver disease. And so while the staging system looks at tumor size and where it's spread, it does not take into account what someone's liver function is. And that's very important in making treatment decisions for each patient. So there's actually multiple staging systems out there. The reason why there's more than one is because none of them really have turned out to be fully comprehensive, that everyone has decided to, you know, to use one. The one that's most commonly used is the Barcelona liver staging system, and that does take into account the extent of the HCC, but also the underlying liver function. And so for that, it's more useful than the AJCC staging system. There is also a whole another group of treatments that can be available to patients who may not be a candidate for transplant or resection, but they still have disease confined to the liver. And for that, our interventional radiology colleagues are able to do some procedures such as radiofrequency ablation, chemoembolization, or radiation that's using radiolabel particles, such as Y90. So there's a lot of specific decision making that goes into what the best treatment is for each patient. And of course, as a medical oncologist, I'm mostly focused on the chemotherapy or systemic treatment for these patients. There is one FDA-approved drug that's named sorafenib or Nexavar. That's a pill that patients take daily, and it's been shown that there is a benefit to patients receiving this drug over placebo. So that is kind of the standard first-line chemotherapy treatment for these patients. But certainly, you know, if someone is a candidate for surgery or other local regional therapies, we usually use those first. Because while chemotherapy does have a benefit, unfortunately, it does not offer a cure.
Can you tell us, with the patients who have localized cancers, how often they are cured and how often they recur?
Well, so for patients that have resection or transplant, we do have, you know, cure rates. Some of that does depend on the extent of their liver disease, the size of the tumor, and also if there's invasion of the tumor cells already in the blood vessels. So that's something we often don't know until the time of resection. So the rates of cure can really change from 80% for those patients down to maybe only 20-something%, depending on whether the tumor was already extending into the vasculature, which we see at the time of resection.
Tamar, can you tell us a little bit about the multidisciplinary tumor board? We've mentioned the word multidisciplinary during this conversation here, but what are really the big advantages for a patient whose case might be discussed in that forum as opposed to some other sort of scenario where that might not exist?
So tumor boards have actually been studied in the literature, and tumor boards are actually accredited boards. They're accredited by the American College of Surgeons and usually by the cancer center that accredits them, wherever that institution may be, in our case at Yale. And they're governed by a series of guidelines in terms of who must be there and how often they must be present. So a typical tumor board, so most tumor boards, consists of a radiologist, a pathologist, an oncologist, a radiation oncologist, a surgeon, for example. And then tumor boards can be tailored to the specific type of cancer. So for example, our tumor board, because there's not a lot of role for radiation oncology, we've substituted the interventional radiologist who has a very key role to play in the management of HCC, or hepatocellular carcinoma. So you basically go before your cancer committee, which we did about a year ago now, and you ask for them to recognize you as a tumor board. And then attendance is taken of all these various disciplines, and that attendance should be at least 90% per year. Minutes are derived from these tumor boards, which are suggestions on the care plan. And then the tumor registrar can act as a liaison to derive data and statistics based on what we're seeing at our particular institution. And most tumor registrars are actually governed by certified, you know, they become certified registrars. And then there's a state registrar who compiles data on different cancers at the end of every year, for example. So there's a lot of oversight. But the role of a tumor board is really multifactorial, or, you know, many different processes happen at a tumor board. Number one, you discuss the case. Number two, it's an open forum in the sense that the people who are there bring their opinions to the table, but that some consensus should be reached on the plan of care with all of these disciplines at the table. And then that plan of care is implemented. So, I mean, obviously understanding that surprises can happen along the way. These are patients, their cases can change, tumors can grow rapidly, et cetera. But it's very important to come up with a consensus because there's so many different treatment modalities for liver cancer and so many different disciplines involved. So even when we say surgery, it's really two surgical disciplines. We have transplant surgery at the table, and we have surgical oncology at the table, both of whom, you know, might have very different opinions. So, for example, once we come to tumor board with a case, we discuss the case, we discuss that patient's liver function. As Stacy said, you really need to know how healthy the liver is and how much injury it might be able to withstand from a resection, for example. So these cases are discussed, and then we present the patient with the plan from the tumor board. Now, again, the literature has shown that tumor boards fulfill two very important roles. Number one, they increase patient satisfaction, and these papers have come from both the urology literature and the gynecology literature, that patients feel more satisfied when they know that, you know, experts have met to discuss their case. Number two, several papers have shown that many more patients are inclined to enroll in clinical trials if they've been brought before a tumor board, because there's now a new drive to discuss clinical trials at tumor boards, and actually tumor registrars collect that data. You know, was the patient discussed in view of the clinical trials available at your institution, for example? So the one benefit I'd like to see from tumor boards is the benefit of survival and earlier detection. And I think we probably will show that, at least in the liver world, but we probably need another 5 or so years to mature that data. Survival takes a while to establish.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the clinical trials that are ongoing at the Smilow Cancer Center in the area of liver cancer?
So I'll talk about just a couple. I'll talk about one, which is a very unique trial. So there's one trial which is looking at the effect of sorafenib, which is this molecular agent. This is looking at the effects of sorafenib on portal pressures. And this is the feeling is that sorafenib may have some antifibrotic properties. And so this was an investigator-initiated trial looking at patients who've had fully ablated or treated liver cancers to see what the role of this drug is on specifically portal hypertension.
Dr. Stacy Stein is Assistant Professor of Medical Oncology, and Dr. Tamar Tadi is Assistant Professor of Medicine and Digestive Diseases at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.